After last year's surprising and tumultuous rulings, eyes are once again trained on the nation's highest court. This hour, a look at four important cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we sit down with two of our regular legal experts, Todd Pettis and Song Richardson of the University of Iowa Law School. They'll tell us about four new U.S. Supreme Court cases, including a civil case that could have significant implications for campaign financing, and a criminal case that involves the question of criminal liability for an Iowa heroin dealer whose client died. A look at what's before the High Court after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today on the program we want to look at cases currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. And we like to do this several times a year with the highest court in the nation and the highest court in the state. And joining us to do that, we have two of our legal experts. Todd Pettis is with us, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Also at the College of Law, our other guest, Song Richardson, where she is a professor of law. And Song and Todd, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so much.
Always eager to hear about the new cases. We have received in the meantime feedback from many listeners that they really enjoy hearing the stories behind these cases, and especially at this time, because often we hear it announced in the press only when the decisions are made, and then also very little about the backstory here. And so this is a chance for us to hear about the stories that become cases and the cases that make their way to the highest court in our land. Let's start off, if we could. We're looking at two criminal cases this hour and two civil cases. Let's start off, if we could. Todd Pettis, more or less the civil cases will be in your hands, and Song Richardson, we'll hand you the criminal cases, and we'll discuss these. Let's start with the civil case that we've heard a lot about, actually, in on public radio. Could mark the most consequential campaign finance decision since the landmark 2010 Citizens United ruling that we'll remember, the ruling that eliminated the ban on corporate spending in elections. So tell us how this case is different and what's at stake.
Well, this case is called McCutcheon versus FEC. That's the Federal Election Commission. Sean McCutcheon, Mr. McCutcheon, is a businessman in Alabama. He and the Republican National Committee are co-parties here. And what they're challenging are what we call aggregate limits that are placed on how much money a person can contribute either to a person running for federal office or to one of the national or state political parties. Aggregate meaning if you add up all together, I'll just give you a simple example. You want to give money to three candidates, four candidates. Well, the law places limits on how much total you can give to all federal candidates who are running. And just quick shorthand, if you were to there are aggregate limits and then there are base limits. There's how much you can give to a particular candidate. So if you were to max out the amount of money you can give to a particular person running for Senate, and then you want to max out how much you can give to someone else running for Senate in another state, you would basically be able to support nine Senate candidates. Mr. McCutcheon says, I want to support many more than nine. I have the financial resources to do it, and I'd like to be able to support as many people running for federal office around the country as I choose. There's also aggregate limits on how much you can give to the national committees, whether it's the Republican National Committee or the Democratic National Committee or their Senate or House counterparts, or to the Iowa Republican Party or the Iowa Democratic Party. So federal law limits how much money goes in. And so this case is about, number one, whether those aggregate limits can be justified, whether they're constitutional. The other thing that this case is about, and depending on how this is decided, this really could become a very consequential decision. The Republican National Committee and some others are asking the Supreme Court to revisit a distinction that the Supreme Court has made for about 35 years now, going back to a case called Buckley versus Valeo from the 1970s. And this is a very basic distinction that shows up in pretty much all of these campaign finance cases, and they're being asked now to take a second look at it. And here's that distinction. The Supreme Court says we're going to distinguish between two things, something that we call contributions and something that we call expenditures. Contributions, that's money that you give to someone for that person to go spend how they choose. So if you decide to run for Senate, Ben, and I write you a check to support your campaign, you decide what ad you want to run. You decide what the message is. That's called a contribution. An expenditure would be if I decide I'm going to go out and spend my own money, perhaps for you, I'll write my own ad. It'll be my own speech. The court has said for a long time now that when it comes to contributions, the court is going to be a little bit more deferential to Congress's judgments. Citizens United, for example, was about expenditures, where the court is less deferential, more skeptical about limits. And so the law as it stands today is I can spend as much money as I want. I can spend millions of dollars trumpeting Ben Kiefer for Senate. But law places sharp limits on how much I can contribute to you. And so this case is about both that distinction and also about this issue of aggregate limits.
And McCutcheon is arguing what here? That money – we have all different amounts of money. He has quite a bit of money. Money equals free speech, and my free speech should not be limited?
It certainly is a free speech argument, and it's not that the money itself is speech, of course, but it's that the money facilitates speech. And so whether you're a media company or an outfit like Iowa Public Radio or the New York Times, you know, speech does cost money. You want to run an ad and you want to maximize the number of people who see it. That costs money. And so this equation between speech and money is, you know, it's the money that facilitates the speech. And he says, I want to be able to support many other candidates and political parties' speeches as I choose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So going back a little bit, curious, so where did these limits come from in the first place?
Well, the amount of money you can give to a candidate, that's been around for well over half a century. I think it was around 1940 or so when Congress started limiting how much you could give to a candidate for office. One of the things that the world of campaign finance is famous for is that when Congress puts limits in one area of the system, that creates pressure, and determined donors and determined candidates find ways to work around those limits. And so the story of campaign finance in 30 seconds is, you know, starting
whack-a-mole.
Exactly. You start in the mid-1900s, Congress places some limits, and then the system matures or devolves or evolves or whatever it does. Congress comes back with more limits. So it's a back and forth between reality, the realities of the way finance and politics works, and Congress's efforts to respond. And right now we're talking about aggregate limits imposed by the McCain-Feingold legislation in 2002. And the court's being asked to weigh in on some pretty fundamental features of that legislation.
Do we have any indications? Do we have any indications as to how the court will rule? Who will be the deciding justices in this case?
Well, this case was argued in early October, so they've had it now for a few weeks. It'll probably be a while before we see the decision come down. To the extent these oral arguments are indicators of what the justices can do, and it's obviously not a reliable basis for making predictions. But a lot of folks took a look at Chief Justice Roberts, both going into the decision and based on some questions he asked during oral arguments. And if the predictions were to hold true, here's what that means about how the case would come out. It would suggest that the four kind of left-leaning justices would uphold all of the limits. There would be another three or four votes to strike them down and perhaps even go back to that distinction between contributions and expenditures and remove it, which would have a lot of consequences, with possibly Chief Justice Roberts being in the middle. And what being in the middle in this case would probably mean is keep the distinction between contributions and expenditures, which gives Congress greater leeway to regulate contributions than it does expenditures, and then say also, we're going to say you can support as many federal candidates as you choose, but these limits on how much you can give to various political parties, to the RNC, to the Republican Senate Campaign Committee, to the Republican Party of Iowa, those limits would get struck would be upheld, rather.
Mm-hmm. And finally, you said this has huge implications, bigger than Citizens United back in 2010, you think, or equally?
If they revisit the distinction between contributions and expenditures and say that we no longer are going to defer at all to Congress when it comes to regulating contributions. So we're going to be much more skeptical about limits, meaning that when Congress tries to self-impose some limits, the court may strike them down. That would probably be equal to, if not exceed, the consequences of Citizens United. If they don't revisit that distinction, this will be an important case, but not any more or less so, I don't think, than a case as familiar as Citizens United.
And we can expect the decision, you said?
Yeah, just predicting it's going to be probably next calendar year. They could surprise us, but my guess is February, March, thereabouts next year.
Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law with us, along with Song Richardson. We're going through four cases, two civil cases, two criminal cases, currently before the high court, the U.S. Supreme Court, talking about what the case is and what's at stake. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about another civil case. This is the town of Greece v. Galloway. Greece in New York, I would think?
In New York. It's a suburb of Rochester. That's right.
And legislative prayer here at issue. Tell us the story.
Yeah, legislative prayer. So the town of Greece, for a number of years now, they hold monthly town council meetings, and they begin each session with a prayer. The prayers are not given by someone paid by the town. Rather, what the town does is it solicits area religious leaders saying, if you want to come in and take your turn, you get on the list, and when your number is up, essentially, you'll come in and you'll deliver the brief prayer.
Christian prayer or of all faiths?
The town does not specify, and that's an important fact in this case. They say it does not have to be a Christian prayer, whatever your faith tradition, but it just so happens, not surprisingly perhaps, that the overwhelming majority of religious institutions in the area are indeed Christian. And so the overwhelming majority of the prayers that have been given are very Christian. Moreover, some of the prayers that have been given have included language that is more specific than, let's say, a generic Judeo-Christian prayer might be. And so some of the prayers have made reference to the death of Jesus Christ on the cross, to the resurrection, to saving sinners from hell, language of that flavor. And two people, one an atheist, another a Jewish woman, have challenged this, saying that it violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which says essentially that government cannot make any law respecting an establishment of religion.
Mm-hmm. Over the decades, this Establishment Clause given a lot of talk, a lot of interpretation. What makes it so flexible, so inexact?
Well, in legal circles, the Establishment Clause is famous for just how confused, by its own admission, the court's rulings have been. The justices themselves have had a very difficult time reaching agreement about exactly what that clause is meant to protect us from. And there are a lot of different theories. And so there's quite a bit of attention being focused on this case, not just for the issue of how is this prayer question, the prayer at legislative sessions, can that happen or not under these circumstances, but also looking to the court to see if this will be a case where they articulate some broader theory that will apply to all kinds of other settings about what work the Establishment Clause is meant to do. Mm-hmm. I'll mention just a few of the candidates.
Please, yeah.
There are some justices on the court who think that what the Establishment Clause is meant to do is just protect you from government coercion to participate in religion. So if the government is threatening you with imprisonment or going to fine you if you don't attend church on the designated day and time, the government can't do that. But if the government is not doing that, then there's no violation. There's others on the court who would take that coercion theory a little bit further and say, well, it's beyond just imprisoning you or fining you. If the government is psychologically trying to coerce you, and then that would be a problem. And there's a case, a narrowly divided case from several years back involving prayer at high school graduations where in an opinion by Justice Kennedy, the court said there's impressionable youths in the audience here. There's prayer being given. We're kind of forcing these young people to participate in a religious exercise.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of other theory. I'll just mention one more. This theory would say the government cannot endorse religion. It can't send you the signal that government really favors this particular religious tradition.
And that could be as little as outside of a federal building a manger scene during Christmas time?
Exactly. In fact, this endorsement theory has been put to some work in what we might call religious display cases. And so if we're speaking here in Iowa City and we have our pedestrian mall, a pedestrians only area in downtown, if the city of Iowa City were to set up a little manger scene with Jesus in the manger, and that's it. It's sitting there in isolation, and the city has put it up. Under the Supreme Court's cases, that would be unconstitutional on the grounds that it is sending passers-by the signal that the city of Iowa City is specifically a Christian community. The court's cases have said that they can't do that. So here we have this legislative prayer case with predominantly Christian prayers, though not by requirement of the town of Greece. That's just how the statistics play out.
But Greece, New York, is a rather diverse community, though, isn't it?
It's a diverse community, but when you look at how many is it sufficiently diverse in the religious dimension of its civic life,
right,
to generate all kinds of different religious communities, Christian and non? And the answer there is no. There are some other religious traditions, but the overwhelming majority are Christian.
I wonder if that would even figure into the court's thinking here, how diverse the community is. Otherwise, you'd have different standards for different communities depending on how religiously diverse they were, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. And so citizens might get more or less protection from the Establishment Clause based on what the makeup of their larger community is, depending on how the court decides this case. I'll mention one little fact about this case that may or may not prove to be important, but that those who don't like this practice are really emphasizing it. At these town council meetings, children often come, and in fact, they're often required to come by local school teachers who say, kids, it's time to get a look at local government. So you need to go watch a town council proceeding and write up a little paper about it. Or maybe there's a scout troop or some other group of children who are there to receive an award. And so those who don't like this practice are saying, kids are there, and the town council is beginning its proceedings with prayers that often reference in very specific ways features of the Christian tradition, and that's coercive of them and anyone else who wants to bring business to the town council in ways that the Establishment Clause should not tolerate. Mm-hmm. That argument will undoubtedly win a few justices. It undoubtedly will lose a few. It's a question of how the count adds up.
Some people may say that's a strange argument to make when we have in God we trust on our coins and we have that reference to God in our Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah, we have religious references in many places. The Supreme Court has pointed out that if you go visit the Supreme Court building and look at the engravings that surround the wall, the courtroom, there's images of Moses with the Ten Commandments all over Washington, D.C. Someone has done a little walking tour of Washington, D.C., and our nation's capital has all kinds of religious references. And the challenge that the court faces in these Establishment Clause cases is trying to draw a line that on the one hand, allows people to express and recognize their religious heritage, and on the other hand, try to put some teeth in the Establishment Clause, whatever those teeth might portend, and say, well, what you can recognize or express your religious background, perhaps within God we trust on the coins, but you can't do this. And what the court has not yet been able to agree upon in a really coherent way is, what's the this? What is it exactly that clause is meant to protect you from? Mm-hmm. The justices just don't see it in one way yet.
We have a few minutes before we take a break. So talk about the way you see the makeup of the court and how this decision is likely to come down.
Well, a lot of attention is being focused on a case from the early 1980s. It's called Marsh versus Chambers and comes from our region of the country, Nebraska. And in that case, the Nebraska legislature began its proceedings daily with a prayer. And the Supreme Court in that case, now a few decades old, Supreme Court in that case said that that was fine. It was permissible. So there's precedent here that at least in part weighs in favor of Town of Greece. I think when the court actually sits down to write this opinion, assuming they stay faithful to Marsh versus Chambers, and I think that they will, a question will be, do things like the presence of children, often the required presence of children at the town council meeting in New York, does that distinguish that case somehow from the Nebraska legislature, where at least as that opinion was written, and at least as we understand the facts from that old case, that no one made much at all of whether children were present. And in fact, when the Supreme Court wrote its opinion in that old case, they said, look, everybody in the legislature is an adult. No one really thinks that an adult is going to hear a prayer at the beginning of the legislative session and feel pressured by it somehow to rethink their own religious commitments. The Supreme Court made that observation. And so one of the issues in the Town of Greece opinion will be, okay, well, now we have kids in the room. They're not part of the town council, but they're there by one requirement or another. Does that make a difference?
Mm-hmm. What implications could that have for our governmental bodies here in Iowa?
Well,
depending on the decision.
It depends whether it's a broadly written or a narrowly written opinion, just like in the last case. If it's a broadly written opinion and the courts were to cohere around a view of the Establishment Clause that says, for example, so long as the government is not coercing you, they are not violating the Establishment Clause, a ruling like that would allow those communities that want to engage in a lot more religious expression through their governments than they currently do. If it's a narrowly written opinion or maybe a divided opinion where, you know, you can't get more than two or three justices to agree on a single viewpoint, so the actual opinion itself reads like a bit of a train wreck, then this decision is just going to be something that deals with legislative prayer in the town of Greece, New York. But the rest of us are going to forget about it and continue doing business in whatever way we do business.
In this case, is it looking like that typical 5-4 split with perhaps Kennedy the decider?
Yeah, it's hard to say. We haven't had the oral arguments yet, which would make it a little bit easier to read the justices. Justice Kennedy is the one who wrote the opinion in that high school graduation case. And so to the extent that has any predictive value, we could say Justice Kennedy, at least on a prior occasion, was one who said that when we're talking about prayers in front of children, we really need to look out for them and what he understands looking out to mean. And so perhaps that means he would tilt against this, but that's very speculative.
Mm-hmm. We have just about a minute left, but we mentioned the diversity of Greece, New York, which is cases involves. You mentioned also the precedent from 1983. Does the court take into account any greater diversity in our country at large when in the intervening 30 years?
Well, again, we can say very little about the Establishment Clause and, quote, the court and what the court thinks. That's part of the point and part of the problem with the Establishment Clause as we understand it now is there's not a unified, well-developed understanding about what that clause means. Instead, we have disagreement among the justices. But there are justices who would say what the Establishment Clause is meant to protect you from are just violations of our historical practices. And if our historical practices are predominantly allow a lot of Christian expression through government, then no matter how diverse the community gets, if nevertheless, if government wants to continue with Christian expression, government can. And the remedy is not to go to court to complain about it, but rather to elect yourself some new governmental leaders, and perhaps they'll make different choices about the kinds of religious expression that they'll put forward.
Okay. Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law, describing in the last half hour two civil cases before the nation's highest court. When we come back, we'll turn our focus to Song Richardson, who will talk about two criminal cases before the high court, a case, in fact, that involves Iowa, involves a question of criminal liability for an Iowa heroin dealer whose client overdosed. That's when we come back. Also, another criminal case that involves the Fourth Amendment, that Fourth Amendment prohibiting unreasonable searches and seizures. And we'll hear those stories, what's at stake in these cases, as we look at what's on the docket of the nation's highest court with Todd Pettis and Song Richardson of the University of Iowa College of Law. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, back in just a few minutes. Great to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We've been hearing about the furor over allegations that the United States spied on some of its closest allies in Europe, but are these revelations really a surprise to our European allies? And what's the political fallout? Two of the questions we'll be dealing with tomorrow. It's Politics Day on River to River. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about this case, these revelations, other eruptions on the political landscape. That's what we like to do on Politics Wednesday. Join us tomorrow. Today, we're looking at four cases currently before the United States Supreme Court and talking them through talking them through. Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, Song Richardson, also of the University of Iowa College of Law, picking these four cases as sort of highlights on the court's docket for this term. And we covered two civil cases in the first half hour. Now time to turn to the criminal cases. In just a moment, we'll talk about a case that involves the Fourth Amendment prohibiting unreasonable searches and seizures. But before that, a criminal case, Barrage v. United States. And Song Richardson, let me turn to you to have us learn the story of this, and it actually involves a drug deal that was done right here in Iowa.
Yes, it does. Mr. Barrage is a drug dealer. He sells heroin. That's one of the drugs that he's accused of selling to Mr. Joshua Banks, who's the victim in this case. And the deal actually took place in a Hy-Vee parking lot in Ames, Iowa. And Mr. Barrage sold 1 gram of heroin to Mr. Banka. And what Mr. Barrage didn't know is that Mr. Banka, the victim, and his wife had been engaged in a multi-day crime spree, purchasing drugs, stealing drugs. And what Mr. Barrage didn't know was that Mr. Banka was also a longtime drug addict. And Mr. Banka, the victim, had actually ingested marijuana, OxyContin, heroin, and other prescription drugs throughout the day. So what happens in this case is once Mr. Barrage sells 1 gram of heroin to Mr. Banka, Mr. Banka goes home with his wife. He starts using all of the drugs, including half of the heroin that he was sold. And unfortunately, the next morning, he was found dead in his bathroom by his wife. So Mr. Barrage was charged with distribution of heroin, for which he could be convicted up to for that crime, and he was, and he could be sentenced to a maximum of 20 years in jail for that distribution.
That time he's serving now.
Correct.
In a prison.
He's serving that time now. And so what's at issue is this case then is a sentencing enhancement. So the federal statute allows the court and a jury to enhance Mr. Barrage's sentence. So instead of facing a maximum of 20 years, mm-hmm. he faces a minimum sentence of 20 years if the state is able to prove that the heroin resulted in Mr. Banka's death. And so that's the question here. How does the state need to prove causation? How does one prove that the heroin was the result of Mr. Banka's death? And so the issue here is none of the experts that the state called, the medical examiner and the toxicologist, neither one was able to say that the heroin itself caused Mr. Banka's death. Rather, it was a combination of all of the drugs that he was using that night and into the next day that caused his death. And so the issue here is how broadly do we read this language in the statute that says we can enhance your sentence to a 20-year minimum if the drugs that you sold resulted in the death of the victim. And so the fight here that we'll see before the Supreme Court is what counts as causation. Mm-hmm. Does the heroin have to directly cause the death?
Or be a contributor.
Or can it be a contributor? And the state's arguing a contribution is sufficient.
Does it matter what the heroin dealer intended, that he did not intend a death here? Does that play into the court's thinking at all?
It should play into the court's thinking, and that's part of what's at issue here, because the government is saying it doesn't matter what he intended. If Mr. Banka's death was a complete accident, if it was completely unforeseeable, we should still be able to enhance Mr. Barrage's sentence. And the state, or the federal government, excuse me, is arguing that the language only requires that the drug sold contribute to the death. It doesn't matter whether the dealer could foresee the death, whether he intended the death. Congress, according to the federal government, thought about this question. And if they wanted to have an intent requirement, they would have included it in the statute, and they didn't. So part of what Congress is thinking, according to the federal government, is we want to deter drug dealers. You take the consequences of your behavior. You were engaged in unlawful conduct, and if someone dies, we will hold you responsible by enhancing your sentence to a 20-year minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
So if you have that as the ruling, then drug dealers beware. They should beware anyway, but anyone listening who might be doing that, you sell someone some drugs. They do something crazy. The drug you sold them is thought to be a chief contributor to that. You're going to be held responsible?
Absolutely, with a 20-year minimum. And it doesn't even have to be a chief contributor. All it has to be is a contributor, if it's a tiny – even if it's only a tiny contribution to the death. According to the government's argument, that's sufficient to – enhance your sentence to a 20-year maximum. And so imagine, for example, if I had surgery and I had been prescribed OxyContin, which is a substance that I should not be – it requires a prescription that I should not be giving away. And my husband's in pain one night. I feel badly for him. I give him one of my OxyContin pills. That's a crime. And then he ingests some alcohol. And of course, my husband would never do this. Let me be clear.
Okay.
He ingests some alcohol and then he dies in his sleep. I could then be charged under the distribution statute for distributing the OxyContin. And then if he dies and the OxyContin contributed, even if just a bit, to his death, I would now face a 20-year minimum sentence for my behavior. And without that, I might just get probation.
Do you think the court will rule as you've just described?
Well, it's difficult in this case because the court has not recently ruled on these issues regarding causation. And because the argument hasn't been held yet, it's difficult to predict which way they'll go. I mean, typically, if we look through the history of the criminal law, requiring some mens rea, some guilty mind, as you were talking about
mens
earlier.
Mens rea is the Latin term for the intent that we were talking about.
Exactly, the intent that we were talking about. Typically, when the common law looks to criminal statutes, you often read in the mens rea requirement, the guilty mind requirement, because we don't want to punish someone with a criminal conviction without having some guilty mind, some culpability on the part of the defendant in the case. Here, arguably, there was no culpability. He didn't know Mr. Banca. He didn't know he was a longtime drug addict. He had no idea that he'd been using all of these drugs for the past 2 days. And so the Supreme Court could decide that we want Congress to be crystal clear when they pass a statute that does not have a guilty mind element. So it may be that the court will say mens rea is a requirement when you want to enhance someone's sentence so much, right? 20-year minimum is a huge enhancement. And typically when the court looks at statutes, they will read in a minimum mens rea requirement when the sentence is extremely high, as it is in this case. So perhaps that will be an issue that the court will focus on in this case. And it has broad effects because there are a number of federal statutes that has similar language, the death results language. So how they rule in this case, if they rule broadly, may affect the interpretation in these other statutes.
Has this case, Barrage v. United States, been heard?
Not yet.
Okay. To be heard. So the decision most certainly then to be heard by us next year sometime. If you just joined us, Song Richardson with us, a professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law, along with Todd Pettis of the College of Law. And we're talking now about moving on to a final case. We've been talking about four cases before the U.S. Supreme Court this term, and we're on our final criminal case, a case that deals with the Fourth Amendment called Fernandez v. California. Song Richardson, the story behind this one.
So this is an interesting case. Mr. Fernandez was convicted or accused of engaging in a violent assault in the streets of Los Angeles. The police hear about it. They go to the alley where they think members of a gang that Mr. Fernandez allegedly belongs to hang out. And while they're there, they see Mr. Fernandez run into a house, and he matched the description of the person who had committed this assault and robbery. So they go to the apartment. They knock on the door. Mr. Fernandez's wife answers. She's holding her little baby. She has a bloody nose and or some blood on her hand and a bruise on her nose. And the police ask her if they can enter the home. And at that point, Mr. Fernandez appears and he says, "I know my rights. You have no ability to enter. I do not want you to enter my home." Mm-hmm. The police then arrest Mr. Fernandez for the robbery and the assault. They come back an hour later and they ask his wife, "Can we search your home?" And there is it's not clear in the record whether her consent was voluntary, but she does give consent. They search the home. They find evidence of criminal activity, which they then use to charge Mr. Fernandez.
So here we have part ownership, one spouse saying, "Do not enter."
Right.
That's the first instance, and then he is arrested. The second one says, "Okay, fine, do enter." So in that case, that must have been happened before. So how do you decide it? Do both have to consent to a search of the property?
So that's a great question. In order to answer that, let me take a step back and just say that the Supreme Court has stated in prior cases that if you live with someone else, you assume the risk that your co-tenant will consent to a search. So as long as one tenant consents to the search, officers can search the common areas of the home. But in 2006, in a case called Georgia versus Randolph, the Supreme Court created a very narrow exception. And they said when both or all co-tenants are present at the time the police ask for consent, the objection of one tenant prevents the officers from searching. But it was narrow in that the court required both people to be present at the time.
And in this case, an hour later after the arrest, the one who objected was not present.
That's exactly right. And that's the question here, right? So clearly they couldn't search when Mr. Fernandez first objected. But after they forcibly remove him, arrest him, and come back later, does the consent then of the co-tenant override the objection of Mr. Fernandez? And it's going to turn on, was the physical absence of Mr. Fernandez important here since he had already objected to the search? So it's an issue of how strong is the objection? Does it remain in place forever until he changes his mind or not?
What about you mentioned the girlfriend in this case had blood on her, perhaps signs of domestic abuse. Does that play into the thinking of the court here?
It will. And Justice Breyer actually was concerned about this issue of domestic violence in the case I just mentioned, Georgia versus Randolph. And if the police determine that there is an immediate need, an emergency for which they have to enter the home, they can always enter the home based on exigent circumstances is what it's called. But they didn't claim that here. Mm. So they didn't – if they had, they could have entered the home over the objection of Mr. Fernandez. But that isn't what they claimed was happening here. And so the issue here really is about the consent exception to the Fourth Amendment. How broadly will the court read this consent exception? Because you can imagine situations if the court says, as long as Mr. Fernandez or the objector is not there, it would be easy for the police to always manipulate the obtaining of consent when you're living with another person, right?
You could just time it right, and you know when the person who will object will leave, and then you say, "Let's go in now and convince that person that we need to get in there."
That's exactly right. And what the defense is arguing here is, look, the Fourth Amendment protects all of our privacy, especially in the home. So shouldn't we require the police to get a warrant first? And that would have been very easy for them to do here. Mm-hmm. They could have called a judge. You can get warrants so easily now and quickly is what I should say, as long as probable cause exists. And they had that because they arrested Mr. Fernandez. They needed probable cause to arrest him. That same probable cause could have gotten them a warrant to search the home, but they did not do that here.
Fascinating case. How do you guess? How do you think it will come out, Song Richardson?
Again, this case has not been argued yet. And so what I find fascinating about it is Georgia versus Randolph, the one that said both people have to be present at the door in order for an objection to keep the officers out. That was, according to every justice on the Supreme Court, a very narrow decision, a very narrow exception to the ability of the police officers to search when just one tenant agrees. So it's going to come down to how narrowly are they going to read that prior decision, and will Justice Breyer be concerned about the domestic violence aspects of this case, because he mentioned that specifically in the prior case that I discussed. So it could be a unanimous opinion, or it could be completely fractured, a close case. We'll have to see.
Okay. Let's talk – in the few minutes we have remaining, let's talk about some other things. News out of the court that's been happening. Todd Pettis, Song Richardson, we have some instances, a lot of media attention in the past few years about how little Justice Thomas speaks. But on the other end of the spectrum, we have one of the newest justices, Sotomayor, who's quite talkative.
Yeah. Last year, the court runs in terms, so they start in the beginning of October and they run till the end of the following June. So that period that closed this last summer, some people who follow the court closely went through all of the transcripts of all of the cases that were argued that year to say who's asking the most questions and who's asking the fewest. Historically, Justice Scalia had been at or near the top of that list, often by a comfortable margin. Last year, Justice Sonia Sotomayor topped that list. So she was the one who asked the most questions. And there's nothing wrong with that. On the other end of the spectrum, we have Justice Thomas, who has had zeros in that column now for a number of years where he hasn't asked any at all. Most of the justices seem to ask about a dozen questions, give or take. And so the reaction to that was a little bit interesting. Some people, I think, thinking that there may be something a little presumptuous about one of the most junior members of the court coming in and being the most talkative and kind of consuming the most time. On the other hand, they all have an equal vote. There's absolutely nothing in the law or in their practices that says that if you are one of the newest members of the court, somehow you are less than the others or need to step aside.
And we know in Congress, in parliamentary procedure, you have to have permission to speak. Not so on the Supreme Court?
Not so. You just open your mouth and ask a question. It's clear in watching the court, if you watch them in the room, sometimes the justices might irritate each other just a little bit when someone is kind of dominating the airtime, so to speak, or
rolling eyes and so forth? Or more subtle than that?
Maybe perhaps a little more subtle than that. Not always, but a little bit more subtle than that. I think one thing that's interesting, I haven't gone through to look at the transcripts. My observation, though, from the oral arguments that I've either seen or listen to online, is I think Justice Sotomayor is asking somewhat fewer questions this year. I don't know whether that's coincidence or a response to a little bit of treatment on the legal blogs about her topping the list.
It's interesting. Back to the Barrage case, is this before the broadcast you mentioned this will actually there'll be a practice session, a mock session having to do with this Supreme Court session?
Yeah, when it's very common practice when an attorney is going to appear before the United States Supreme Court. And by the way, those attorneys are the envy of everybody else in the legal community. It's very stressful, but clearly a great thrill and highlight of one's career to be able to go argue before those justices. It's common practice to go look for places to practice, regardless of what the cause is or the client or the legal issues. It totally doesn't matter. You go try to find two or three or four places where we have law-educated people who will get to know that case a little bit and help you practice. And so the attorneys in this case, Angela Campbell and Gary Dickey, are arguing that case out of Des Moines. They're going among their practice rounds. They're going to come to the University of Iowa Law School this week and do a session of practice, which will give our students a terrific chance to see some folks who are headed to D.C.
Will people actually play the parts of the justices in this mock trial?
Yeah, it's very much like presidential debates where people will stand in the role. You're getting ready to do a primetime presidential debate, so you find someone to play the role of your opponent and the questioners. It's a bit like that. where law faculty or law students or local attorneys or whatever the panel might be stand in for the role.
Are
of the
you
justices.
Todd Pettis playing a role?
I'll play a role. My colleague here, Song Richardson, will play a role. We'll have some students play the role.
You're not going to tell us which roles.
We don't sign. It's not as if someone says I will be Justice
Thomas.
I thought it was
practicing for a part maybe in the school play, but not
it's,
so.
It's slightly more generic than that.
Given this conversation, perhaps I will play Justice Sotomayor. I was going to play Justice Thomas, but I think I'll change my position.
This is something for the students to watch. There were some media invited here. Very interesting. And thank you for another very interesting hour talking about these four cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Todd Pettis and Song Richardson of the University of Iowa College of Law, always such a pleasure to have you in to tell
thank
us
you.
These stories and talk about the underpinnings of the law in this country and in the civil and criminal cases.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Tomorrow on this program, we've all heard about the furor over these allegations that the United States spied on some of our closest allies in Europe. But are these revelations really surprise? Or what's the political fallout? A couple of the questions we'll be asking tomorrow on this program, Politics Day. Of course, all other things on our political landscape that have been happening. We hope you'll join that discussion tomorrow on River to River. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.